morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of February. Our guest, the first half hour of the program today, says over the years he has shared many worries about the rise of drones, the illusion of withdrawal, the militarization of the CIA, the corruption of law, the evasion of congressional restraint, the risk of mission creep, and the proliferation of signature strikes. But civilian casualties when it comes to drones, that's not an argument against drones. It is the best thing about them. Our guest, the second half hour of this hour, writes recently in the New York Times, President Obama has refused to tell Congress or the American people why he believes the Constitution gives or fails to deny him the authority to secretly target and kill American citizens who he suspects are involved in terrorist activities overseas. So far, he has killed three that we know of. Drones this hour of the program with two guests. We'll be starting with Will Salatin, who's a writer for Slate, who covers science, technology, and politics. And later in the hour, Vicki Dyvel, who's a lawyer and national security expert, former general counsel to the Senate Committee on Intelligence and former deputy legal advisor to the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. All hour, we welcome your phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Get your calls in early. Last time we talked about this issue, we were flooded with phone calls. Will, thank you very much. Oh, did we say? Yeah, we said that Will is a science, technology, and politics expert for Slate. And William, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
First sentence is in a piece that you wrote, drones are the worst form of war except for all others. They're the worst form of what are the others?
Oh, well, if you go back over the history of war, we've used much cruder weapons than this. If you, look back at, of course, the horrible trench warfare of World War One, for goodness sake, we had, fire bombings in Europe in World War Two. We had Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We had carpet bombing in Vietnam. Even if you go back to the Kosovo War, we had, bombing of civilian areas in Serbia, and drones, as unpleasant as they are, because they are killing people, are doing it in a more discriminating way than any previous weapon that we've used in a war.
You list a lot of statistics in your article, and we hear varying statistics about the number of people, the number of civilians, compared to the number of combatants who have been killed by drones. The figures seem to be all over the place, aren't they?
Yeah, and I wouldn't put too much stock in anyone's exact figures, because the truth is, of course, in the fog of war, people are getting killed left and right, and it's often difficult to sort out exactly who's who and what the exact numbers are. But as a ballpark, you can make certain, you can draw certain conclusions. And it is certainly true if you look at all of the estimates of civilian fatalities and casualties from drones, and you look at all of the estimates of civilian casualties and fatalities from past wars, that drones, that the ballpark of drones is much better than the ballpark of the weapons of past wars.
When we look at the number of members of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban who have been killed, how are we keeping track of those numbers, and have we killed a significant number of Al-Qaeda Taliban members through the use of drones?
Yeah, the drone strikes, actually the accounting is better than a lot of the for example the Afghan war. We have very little idea how many Taliban that we've killed through conventional warfare. But in Pakistan, drone strikes are pretty well reported by the press. And there are, in addition, if you don't like one of the watchdog organizations that compiles these press reports and intelligence reports, for example, if you feel that Long War Journal, which records a very low number of civilian fatalities, if you feel that they're being too charitable to the U.S. government, you can go to New America Foundation, you can go to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Those are three different organizations that use three different accounting methods to conclude how many civilians have been killed by the drone strikes. And you can sort of pool, you can just, you know, average those out and see what you think the exact number is.
What about the number of strikes? Has it gone up from year to year, Will?
Yeah, it has changed from year to year. There have been years when it's gone up and down. It is certainly true that on the whole, there have been way more drone strikes under President Obama than under President Bush. Now, some of that is that we simply are building and deploying more drones. And if Bush had been able to do this, he would have done it. So Obama is the beneficiary of that in terms of having the weapons at his disposal. But part of it also is, let's be honest, Barack Obama does not want the heavy footprint wars of the Bush years. He does not want massive troop deployments. He does not want prolonged wars and American casualties. So it's much easier to basically target and kill these enemies. You can call them terrorists. You can call them insurgents or militants in a way that doesn't put U.S. troops at risk on the ground. And that's a big reason why President Obama has become such a fan and user of drones.
Tell me what it's like to fly a drone. Tell me what it's like in terms of how you fly them, in terms of how accurate they are, in terms of how cutting edge they are when it comes to warfare.
Well, the experience of flying, remember, they're not autonomous. They're not robots.
Right.
They are remotely piloted. They still have you are still a pilot. You still pilot this craft. You just aren't there. Think about operating a video game. So you are sitting in a console, say in an Air Force base in Nevada, or in a CIA facility, in the case of the CIA drones. And there are multiple people who are tracking each drone. There's an operator. There are people watching the intelligence. They're watching the video feed, and so it's a group effort. There are a lot of people involved in it. What's really good about operating a drone is, look, think about being a pilot of a fighter jet or a bomber. You have been called in for air support on a ground combat situation in Afghanistan, and you see these people, and you think that it's that their enemy, and you have a very short window of time to make a fatal decision about killing them. And we have had horrible, horrible mistakes. You know, you kill a wedding party, you've just hit the wrong people. When you're operating a drone, you're in complete safety. You have a long time to study your target. And you just have a much better ability to identify that, you know what, in fact, these are not enemy. The people that you're thinking of shooting at are actually civilians, and you don't pull the trigger. And that's a big reason why drones save lives.
And what about the people who are conducting these operations? Is it a whole differently trained group of people that coming from different departments, much more technology-related?
Well, you know, piloting a modern military aircraft has been technologically complicated for quite some time. And now what you're doing is we are training people to operate these remotely piloted vehicles, and these are people who are now being trained by the military specifically to operate drones, and they can't turn them out fast enough, because the drones are coming off the assembly line, you know, as fast as we can put them out. And we're actually just trying to create enough people who are trained and equipped to administer them.
What about other countries? Are they using these as well?
Yeah, other countries are certainly trying to get there. There have been various reports of countries like China, Iran, certainly Israel operating drones. A lot of countries have unarmed drones. They're just, you know, drones originally were just surveillance craft. You're spying. And a lot of countries have something like that. But in terms of an armada of armed drones that can go out and kill people, that's right now, that's just us.
We'll talk about what your concerns are. You say in your article that you've shared your worries. We'll talk about your worries in a moment. First, let's take a few phone calls. Will Salatin is our guest, the first half hour, writer for Slate, who covers science, technology, and politics, and has written a piece, has written extensively about drones, but recently has written a piece, Drones Are the Worst Form of Warfare, Except for All of the Others. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org. Scott in La Crosse, our first caller. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
Enjoying the program as always.
Thanks.
Have a question for you, sir. I have heard on National Public Radio, other programs, that these drones are really very low, slow flying aircraft. So I guess my question is, particularly in the case of somebody like Pakistan, who I'm assuming has a reasonable air force, or certainly anybody else that wanted to shoot them down, that really wouldn't be that difficult. Now, is that true? And if so, why aren't we hearing about more of these things being taken down?
Well, actually, we do hear about them being taken down. The problem is the U.S. government doesn't confirm any of this. Iran, I believe, has claimed to have downed at least two of our drones. Spy drones, in their case. We haven't been sending armed drones over them, not that I know of. We know that Russia shot down a Georgian spy drone. Basically, drones are a weapon that you can operate over, say, a failed state. So they're perfectly good for use in Yemen or the tribal areas of Pakistan, something that's essentially ungoverned. But if you tried to operate them over a sovereign state with anti-aircraft weaponry, they would take you down.
The one who seems to be the most vocal in opposing these, being Pakistan, does anybody ever point out to them that, you know, that they could be up there scrambling their air force and shooting things down?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And not to put too fine a point on it, but the government of Pakistan has essentially been lying to its people for years and years. The government has winked and nodded and approved our use of drones only in the tribal areas, not in the rest of Pakistan, but in the area that they don't really govern, where Al-Qaeda has most infested. We operate the drones there with the approval of the Pakistani government, but they have to pretend for domestic consumption that they hate it.
Amazing. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott, for your call. Lines are open for you if you'd like to join our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. William, you've said that over the years you've shared many worries about the rise of drones. What are some of those worries?
Well, you think about what's good about drones and just turn that around. So, for example, we can now go out, hunt, and kill terrorists, enemies, whatever you want to call them, without any risk to ourselves. That's awfully tempting, right? So the first problem is that it used to be that you had a high threshold for going to war, but now you don't exactly have to call it war. You can send these drones out and essentially engage in unilateral lethal violence, which is what the United States is doing right now. You're pretty much outside of any legal structure. So now we get to the next point, which is that, there are people who think that it is against international law for us to be operating drones the way we do. Some think it's even against domestic law for us to be killing U.S. citizens overseas. We can. The drones allow us to do that without paying the political price that our government would pay if we sent troops off to war. So those are a couple of the problems that we face. And, you know, there's always the risk that if you start with drones, you can end up escalating into a more serious war.
We go to Tom in Whitefish Bay next. Hi, Tom. Tom, are you there?
I'm here.
Go right ahead, sir.
I'm a Vietnam veteran. My time in Vietnam, I called it airstrikes as an infantry radio operator. I helped kill people. One of the things I find so disturbing about this is, to me, it's illogical, it's immoral, and it's unethical what we're talking about. We're talking about killing people. And we're talking about doing it because we think we're the nation that has to run the world. We never think about the fact that we spend billions of dollars on this, and all we're doing is creating more terrorists. Every time we kill somebody with a drone, how many more terrorists do we create? When are we going to start thinking about why are these people mad at us? Why are these people so angry they're willing to sacrifice their lives to kill their own country people in hopes of getting to the United States? It's just to the United States.
William.
Well, that's a perfectly legitimate argument. My response would be that is an argument not against drones, but against war in general. And a lot of people who get upset about drones are really upset about war, and they believe that war is either just simply immoral or counterproductive in this case. And that's a fine argument to make, but I would suggest that if we were to engage in war, when we have engaged in war, by means other than drones, such as, for example, the invasion of Iraq, that has been both more immoral in terms of killing civilians and more counterproductive in terms of generating additional terrorists.
You know, how do we know this? He asks a very legitimate question, that if drone strikes go astray and you're killing civilians in northern Pakistan or wherever it happens, that you get more people to join the very force that you're trying to get rid of. Do we know how effective we've been here, how effective these strikes have been in really lessening the numbers of terrorist groups?
Well, that's hard to tell. I mean, of course, they take people off the board. They say we killed, you know, I mean, I don't know how many times we've killed the so-called Al-Qaeda number three, and they just keep replacing them, of course. Over time, that certainly has an effect on Al-Qaeda. The people that they promote to replace those who have been killed are less experienced. They're less able to threaten the United States. So it has a positive effect in that way. However, it's certainly true that every time you use force in somebody else's country, you know, you're pissing people off and you're making them angry and you're hurting the moral brand of the United States. A lot of people, however, I would still say that if you look at the history of the drone program in terms of the civilian death rate year by year, it has actually been getting better. That is, all of the objections people have raised and said, you know, you have to not kill civilians, you have to not generate more anger at the United States, seems to be having an effect on the caution that we take in making sure we don't shoot the wrong people.
Thank you, Tom, very much for your call. Pat in Richland. Hi, Pat.
Yeah, good morning. Let's say I just got on, so I didn't hear your guest credentials. Is he a professor or something somewhere?
He is a writer for Slate who covers science, technology, and politics.
Oh, just one suggestion before I get to the next question, which is if he wants people to really take him serious as an objective observer to this, quit referring to it as we, and start calling it Washington, because they're the ones sending out the drones. But I'd like to ask him what he thinks Washington's reaction will be the first time some country uses a drone to, you know, make a hit in the United States.
Well, I think, of course, we'd be very upset about it, and people have said it. And I don't think it's wrong to say we, for the simple reason that we are responsible for this. It's our country. If we don't like this policy, we can go to the polls and change it. A lot of people who voted for Barack Obama, for example, thought that he would be a less warlike president than George W. Bush, and in some ways that's true, but there is no question that drone warfare has escalated under Barack Obama, and to pass that off as Washington and not something that is ours, I think is a mistake civically. So I think we should own it, and if we don't like it, we should change it.
How do you know when to stop the policy?
Well, you know, I think you have to you have to watch yourself. For example, when we started with drone strikes, they were what we called targeted strikes. We knew exactly who we thought we were shooting at. We were trying to get this particular guy, and we think this is him. Later, because we had the weapons available, we had these drones flying over Pakistan, and we're looking down, and we started to do what we called signature strikes. And that's where you say, I don't know exactly who this guy is, but we have this list of behaviors that we associate with people who are plotting terror or Al-Qaeda operatives. And when a person we're observing starts to fit enough of these characteristics, we shoot at him. Now, that is a slippery slope, and I think you have to watch yourself and notice when you've crossed these lines and say, you know, this is getting a little bit out of hand, and nobody seems to be stopping us, but maybe we better stop ourselves.
We go. Thanks, Pat, for your call. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the program. I high praise to Wisconsin Public Radio for doing this. But the kind of soul searching that America should have been doing over these last decades about being at war is just not going on elsewhere. I mean, the major networks should be talking about this form of warfare and having all kinds of call-in shows about what constitutes honor and courage and victory in war. And so I think this is wonderful that you're talking about it and we're thinking about it. But I've lived through almost 20 years now of America thinking that it wasn't at war when it was at war. And I think more has to be required of us. I mean, we're just ending two wars that we didn't even pay for. And we're wondering what happened to our economy. So thank you, but I think Americans are on automatic pilot themselves when it comes to warfare.
Thanks, Rich. William?
Well, I think you've just identified a really, really profound challenge of drone warfare, and that is exactly what you said. We feel like we're not at war. We don't have troops over there, right? President Obama just gave his State of the Union address and said, we're coming home. We're coming home. The drones aren't coming home. The drones are going over there. They're part of what's replacing our troops. And so we are morally and mentally disengaging, but we're still killing. Now, I think we're killing in a safer way. We're killing fewer civilians, but it's like we've just turned away and now we're blind to it. And, you know, it is part of our job to keep track of what our country is doing.
And how forthcoming do you think, or how much more forthcoming should the CIA and President Obama and Congress and everybody be in informing us about this whole program, what the long-term plans are, the number of targets that they have successfully destroyed, the number of civilians that they have most unfortunately killed, the whole program itself? We not only don't talk about it, we don't know very much about it.
Yeah, well, I hope that they're more forthcoming, and certainly the need to get the new CIA director, John Brennan, confirmed has forced the administration to be more open with the Senate, at least, about the drone program than it was before. However, I, as a journalist, my job is not to trust the United States government. My job is to try to find out the truth and publicize the truth anyway. And then if they want to come along later and say, well, the cat's out of the bag, so now we'll talk publicly about the drone program, which in effect is what's happening, great. But it's our job as citizens to find out the truth and to let people know about it.
Thank you very much for being with us, William.
Thank you, Kathleen.
William Salatin, a writer for Slate who covers science, technology, and politics. He has a piece that he wrote last Tuesday, February 19, which you can find online. Drones are the worst form of warfare except for all the others. We continue our conversation about drones. Joining us in just a moment, Vicki Dyvel, former general counsel to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and former deputy legal advisor to the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. She wrote a piece recently in which she asks, provocatively, who says you can kill Americans, Mr. President? President Obama has refused to tell Congress or the American people why he believes the Constitution gives or fails to deny him the authority to secretly target and kill American citizens who he suspects are involved in terrorist activities overseas. So far, he has killed three that we know of. We'll take more phone calls as well. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Vicki Dyvel is our guest, former general counsel to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, former deputy legal advisor to the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. She provided guidance on a variety of issues, including criminal law, human rights, overseas covert operations, and interaction among U.S. intelligence agencies. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her. She wrote a piece. This is on our Facebook page, and so is the previous article that we talked about. And you can go to the Kathleen Dunn Show if you'd like to read this as we're talking, or certainly shortly thereafter. Her piece appears in the January 16 New York Times, Who Says You Can Kill Americans? Mr. President, Vicki, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hello. My pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you.
Can you first explain to us, if we have this information, how the program of targeted killing works? Who makes the decision? How does it work?
Well, part of the problem that many of us, including your previous guest, have been talking about is we don't really know. The program, in terms of killing by drones and certainly killing by other means, is still a secret program. I have to get a classification review every time I write anything, and I had to get a review for my op-ed from the Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA.
Really?
And when I talked about the drone program, I had to add in, according to reports, because it is still not officially acknowledged, even though drones are very loud, and we see them, and we know who owns them, so it's a little bit difficult for them to continue calling it a covert program when we can see it with our own eyes.
And the reason for doing this would be, quote, national security concerns.
The reason for keeping it classified?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, of course, any programs like this that the CIA may or may not engage in, and again, I'm not saying that they do here because I don't know. I haven't been privy to that classified information for a few years now, but there are a number of reasons why any particular program is kept secret. One of them, in a case like this, includes the our relationships with nations overseas, both our intelligence liaison relationships and our, you know, foreign policy type relationships with those countries. And a program, even one such as this, which is pretty obvious that it's occurring, if we acknowledge it, then we haven't given that nation in which this is happening the ability to say to its own population, we don't know anything about this. So it's a little bit smoke and mirrors, but it all has a underlying, I believe in secret operations, so I believe that, you know, we do need to have that ability. This program, though, is much more warlike than clandestine, and I think that in war we need to have more transparency.
Mm-hmm. Why is it more warlike?
Well, we're killing people, and you know, traditionally, the CIA and intelligence agencies don't do that. In fact, when the Congress discovered in the 70s that they were doing that, targeting world leaders and other such persons for killing, they told them not to do it anymore. Part of what led to the Church Commission hearings and resulted in, not by statute, by the way, but by executive order, a ban on assassination. So this has not been a legitimate part of the CIA's bag of tricks over the years.
Mm-hmm. And you write in the piece in the New York Times that we have so far killed 3 American citizens. They have been secretly targeted and killed. We don't know the process by which that happened. And I'd like for you to talk about your deep concerns killing American citizens overseas.
Well, yes. My writings have focused primarily, I mean, I've spoken and talked about the targeted killing concept generally from a moral and legal point of view. But starting in 2010, when there were reports that we were targeting and killing, perhaps killing Americans, and then we later did kill Anwar al-Awlaki in 2011, my focus became, looking at that issue because that was new. And we were, the concept of targeting is identifying a person by name, collecting information about them, making a determination that the information we think we know about them justifies killing them, and then proceeding to do so. It appears that there's much hand-wringing that goes on in that process, particularly where an American is concerned, but it is, again, not a process that we have a lot of visibility into, and it raises constitutional questions. It raises separation of powers questions when it comes to killing Americans.
Mm-hmm. And there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of American concern about this, maybe because we don't know, or maybe because of the same reason that we tended to ignore people at Guantanamo. Well, most of us think that they were probably terrorists anyway, so who cares?
I think that's exactly right. And in fact, it would seem to me that once we started targeting Americans, there would be more hue and cry within the general public. And there wasn't. You know, in 2010 when he was targeted and 2011 when he was killed, again, based on reports, that the American people and the Congress seem to be, you know, our representatives on these issues seem to be asleep at the switch. Now, since January, in the last couple of months, there's been a lot more attention paid to it, in part, I think, because of the nomination of John Brennan.
Yes.
And other things, other revelations that have been made. And but even with that, I've seen reports that 79% of the American people are perfectly happy with it and happy with it to include Americans. So, yes, I don't think there's a lot of concern in the general population. I don't know what it would take for that concern to increase, if anything. And if there's no interest in the population, there, of course, won't be any interest in Congress. So, because they're inextricably linked.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the political issues, obviously.
But there is some interest, forced interest on the part of the courts. And one of the, can you tell us about the lawsuits? Some
yes.
family members have filed suit, haven't they?
Yes. Family members have filed suit, both when Mr. Alawaki was placed on the list initially, and now they have, that suit was thrown out of court, and they have a more recent suit as well. Another lawsuit, in fact, the one that prompted my op-ed in January and prompted a lot of interest in this issue, involved the lawsuit by the New York Times and the ACLU, New York Times reporters, to try to get access under the Freedom of Information Act to the legal memoranda in the administration justifying this program. You know, this is secret law. They claim they have the legal right to do it, but we don't know what the law is. And what a judge, a federal judge, said in I believe the decision came out in December or January, was that under Freedom of Information Act law, grudgingly, she said, no, you don't have to produce that information to the under the Freedom of Information Act. So in the course of that, she raised eyebrows in her opinion about the program itself. And I think that caught a lot of attention because finally we have a federal judge saying that she has due process concerns and other concerns about this program where it comes to Americans. Her opinion didn't mean anything legally because she could only rule on the FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act question. But certainly it was eye-opening to see a federal judge say those kinds of things.
Now, I don't know how much you can talk about here, so go where you can. You know that. But you worked on the hunt for Osama bin Laden. I know the programs that would capture him or kill him.
Yes.
Pre-9/11, harsh interrogation, detention, and certainly killing were not on the table, you have said. Were there programs that you thought were particularly effective in trying to rid the world of terrorists, or as we progressed in all of this and post 9/11, when you weren't doing this anymore, but were there concerns that you had about secrecy or the way that we were going about fighting terrorism?
Well, it's a great question. My time at the agency was pre-9/11, but my time on the committee, the Intelligence Committee, was during and post 9/11. So I saw it from both sides in terms of timing and both sides in terms of branches of government. Pre-9/11 was a very, very different time. You know, terrorism was certainly a big focus within CIA, and we were fighting as hard as we could to get the resources and the presidential and congressional authorities to do what the operations people in the agency believed would make a difference. And with, you know, often without success. I mean, a lot of it has been declassified because of the 9/11 Commission review and report. And yes, I did work on the hunt for bin Laden. But in those days, the focus was on what can we do to him, how can we do it, who can do it. And that was all intimately taken apart and put back together. And the feasibility of capture, which is an issue in the targeted killing debate today, was a very big issue in the bin Laden chase back before 9/11. And in fact, many people then at the agency believed we could have killed him, but that the policymakers, the president himself, President Clinton, would not give that go-ahead and kept the feasibility of capture notion front and center, which, as you can see, when we ultimately did capture or kill
mm-hmm.
bin Laden, from what reports we've seen, capture was not a big part of it.
Let's go to phone calls for you. Vicki Dyvel, former general counsel to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, former deputy legal advisor to the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, is our guest this part of the program as we talk about drones and her concerns. She has many of them, but the writings that she has have centered on killing American citizens who are suspected to be involved in terrorist activities overseas. And she asked the question why the president, and the president needs to answer the question to tell Congress and the American people why he believes the Constitution gives or fails to deny him the authority to secretly target and kill Americans. Our phone number, join us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. And Vicki's article is on our Facebook page as well, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Mike in Appleton is our first caller for you. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Well, it's a complicated issue, but let's look at a hypothetical case. We have a citizen who is overseas and has done harm or is planning to do harm to the United States or other citizens. And so we have two alternatives. We either take him out or we arrest him. Now, you know, I mean, if this guy is in the middle of Afghanistan, arresting him is probably not an option. So what do we do? Nothing?
Well, I mean, that's really the central question in all of this. The last comment, part of your comment mentioned Afghanistan. The issues are quite different if we're talking about Afghanistan or an active battlefield, in which case the military would take the role, and it would depend on, you know, whether they are acting within the proper confines of military action and whether they have the proper congressional authorization, et cetera, which at the moment people believe that they do. It's when we start going outside that zone and start using CIA or other special operations forces clandestinely to take those actions that it gets a little more complicated. Now, for many people, it's not more complicated, and I think the caller's suggestion is that it isn't. If he's a bad guy who might harm us, then we better do something about it.
Let's talk a little bit about what's been going on in Congress. You write that a few of our representatives have spoken up, but you qualify that by saying, sort of.
Yeah. Well, they're stepping up a little bit more. I don't think there's been enough attention to oversight of the program itself. And more of what we've heard, particularly lately, is anger about their access to information and access to legal memoranda justifying it. You know, at some point, Congress has to stop squabbling about what they have access to, though I personally believe they should have access to all of it, and I believe it's a constitutional imperative that they have that. But at some point, they have to just step up and go to the substance and stop quibbling about memos, which they do or do not have. Interestingly, the president, after this brouhaha started in the last few weeks, the president, according to Senator Ron Wyden, called Senator Wyden, who's been outspoken on this, and said, you're getting the memos. You're getting the classified memos. And then it turns out we've seen since that, no, he didn't. He and his colleagues on the Intelligence Committee got a couple of them, but there are several others they didn't get. And so, you know, communication with Congress, putting Congress in a position to do the job that the Constitution envisioned for them and that we elected them to do, which is to be our eyes and ears on these matters that we can't know about, is a problem right now.
Congress was harder on Alberto Gonzalez in 2005?
Yeah, I would say so. If you look at any of the videos, and that starts to get into the partisan question, were they harder on Bush's use of the rule of law or abuse because he was the Senate was in Democratic hands and the chairman of the Judiciary Committee was Senator Leahy, than they have been of Attorney General Holder and a president of their own party. And I think for me, it's crystal clear, and it's no great surprise, but it's crystal clear that they were much harder on Gonzalez and they basically forced him to resign.
Mm-hmm. Pat in East Troy, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. First of all, I don't like President Obama. Did not vote for him, and I just don't like him. I don't like most of his policies. But in this situation with drones, first of all, I believe that they do save American troops' lives. And second, I think many people are forgetting that we were at war. And if you were during World War II, Vietnam War, or whatever, and you turned in some of the American troops, and you were caught doing it, you would be shot. And if an American is treasonous, in my opinion, that, you know, being killed by a drone strike would be a consequence of that, and it would be a just consequence.
Well, I think you're, again, your callers are excellent. I think you're articulating a dilemma that a lot of people have pointed to. But, you know, in my view, you kind of are mixing your metaphors here. In the one sense, you talk about battlefields and Americans being shot. No one, but I certainly don't disagree with the idea that if an American citizen joins the enemy and is on the battlefield, we are perfectly within our rights to kill him like we would kill anyone else with whom we are doing battle. And there's plenty of law and evidence that supports that. But that's not what this is. We have declared the world as a battlefield. All bets are off. And once you start doing that, you're bringing the war model into, you know, Rome, into Brussels, into Detroit, for all we know, which is another issue we can talk or not talk about.
Right.
And the rules have to change. We can't just say, okay, it's war, it's not law enforcement. You've used the term treason. That's a crime. Criminals get due process. Criminals are brought before judges and have lawyers. These people are not getting any of those protections.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Vicki Dyvel, former general counsel to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, former deputy legal advisor to the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, is our guest. She worked directly on the hunt for Osama bin Laden pre-9/11. We'll be taking more phone calls momentarily. One line is open for you, 800-486-8655, or feel free to use our email, too, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Learning to Read. One of our guests tells us this remarkable story of his journey from a corporate boardroom to creating libraries and schools in third world countries. And then we'll also have a local literacy expert who is the director of literacy services of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. We'll talk about programs taking place here, teaching people to read, which changes your whole life, right? All right, back to phone calls for Vicki. Just a reminder that her article and William's article, first half hour guest, are on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Mike in Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
I wanted to call and make a valid point. I feel that, you know, how are we supposed to, as citizens of this country, trust this government that says, you know, this person overseas who is a citizen is definitely a threat, where, you know, they gave us reports that there was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and it was necessary for us to go into this country. And then we get in there, we destroy the country, we take out their leaders, and there's no weapons of mass destruction found, none. I mean, that's a pretty big oops that they've created, and also put doubt in my heart that these men are 100% accurate with their intel, you know. And as a citizen, what defines a threat to the country? Now, say there's somebody who is a pacifist who, regardless of political agendas, goes overseas to feed the children of people who are considered terrorists. Are they now a threat to our country and need to be bombed by somebody? You know,
Vicki.
Well, I love this point because the who decides, what standard are they applying, mm-hmm. what information are they using to decide if a particular person meets that standard, are all A, unknown to us, B, completely within the executive branch with no oversight from the other branches, and C, rife with the possibility of error, exactly as the caller said. We do. I mean, I worked in intelligence. Intelligence is not proof of anything, nor would any intelligence officer claim that it is. Intelligence collection are indications of things. They tell us, you know, what we think might be the answer. And when you put all the information together from intercepts and human sources, you hope you learn things. But none of it would ever be admissible in a court of law. Why? Because it's not reliable. People lie. Intercepts are false. You know, all of these things. And this is what we are relying on in making these decisions, and it can lead to error. And that's part of what the Due Process Clause is about, which is why many people are saying, with respect to Americans at least, we should have more review, probably by judges, is we want to get the answer correct. We want to make sure that there's the right eyes on this question, that they're looking at reliable information, and they're making the right choices. We know that they make mistakes, including an individual who was picked up, a gentleman named Al-Masri, a German citizen, and detained in a black site before the black sites were taken down. Turns out they had the wrong guy, and they ended up letting him go by the side of the road somewhere. Well, if he had been a target of a drone attack, he wouldn't be able to be let go by the side of the road somewhere. So I think it's a great point.
Mike, thanks so much for your call. Peter in Baraboo. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. Much of the discussion here is the distinction between American citizens acting and, you know, other nationalities. I know this is a very slippery slope. I'd be interested in hearing some discussion regarding the parallel between an American citizen, Timothy McVeigh, and his actions, and the conversation going on. Take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, by mentioning Timothy McVeigh at the end of your question, you've brought two different issues into account, and that is whether the person targeted is an American citizen and whether the conduct occurs in the United States. When you've got a conduct occurring in the United States, such as the Tim McVeigh attack, that is pure law enforcement. This intelligence agencies have nothing to do with that. It's an American person or anyone committing a crime inside the United States. But when you talk about an American citizen overseas, which is so far, and the president has promised us that he has no plans to use drones in the United States, at least not now, we're talking about the difference between targeting an American citizen and a foreigner. And a lot of people have a lot of problems with drawing that distinction from a human rights point of view. We are all human beings, and we should enjoy the same protections and rights as any other. But in our system, we have a United States Constitution, and it has meaning, and it gives protections inside the United States to everyone, and it gives a few special protections outside the United States to American citizens. So it allows us to bring into this discussion constitutional law concepts. When you're talking about killing foreign people in foreign places, you have international law, perhaps. You have questions of morality. You have all sorts of questions you can look at. But you can't look at the United States Constitution for those answers. And I think that unless the Supreme Court changes its mind on that, and I don't think it will, it's special for us.
Time for maybe one more phone call. Laura in Madison. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I know there's no legal definition of terrorism, but it seems to me that it applies here because of the scope of the damage, the violence inflicted, the collateral damage involved, and it's being done in countries that we have no formal declarations of war in. Doesn't this amount, especially in the eyes of the world, to United States-sponsored terrorism?
So you're asking whether, let me make sure I understand your question, you're asking whether our drone attacks are acts of terrorism.
Yeah, let's take that as a question. We have about 30 seconds left.
I think that, there are definitions of terrorism out there in the legal context, and I think that this would not qualify. Certainly the people who are having Hellfire missiles rained upon them would disagree. But terrorism is a violent act used to coerce a population or a government, and that's not what this is.
And thank you very much, Laura, for the call. Thank you, Vicki. So we're flooded with phone calls. It's an issue
great.
That a lot of people want to talk about, and I thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Vicki Dyvel, our guest this part of the program. Vicki has an interesting background, and we're delighted to have her with us for this half hour. She's a former general counsel to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, former deputy legal advisor to the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. You can find her op-ed piece, Who Says You Can Kill Americans, Mr. President, on our Facebook page, and also our first guest, William Salatin, his article in defense of drones, also on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production here in Milwaukee. News coming up. We'll return.